from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson was abruptly dismissed on Wednesday, it not only sent shockwaves through that venerable institution, it also sent ripples across news and management circles everywhere. Abramson was the first female editor of the Times, so her firing was, as the New Republic's Rebecca Traister put it, freighted with outsized meaning. So was her departure just because of an issue with management, as publisher Arthur Sulzberger obliquely put it, or does it also represent a cautionary tale about the perils that women in management face everywhere? We'll explore that question next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When New York Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger called Jill Abramson in the fall of 2011 to tell her she was his choice to be the next executive editor of the New York Times, Abramson responded that it would be the honor of her life. Later, she even got the scripted T of the Times logo tattooed on her back. Abramson was the first woman to lead the paper in its 160-year history. But on Wednesday, less than 3 years into her tenure, Jill Abramson was abruptly fired. A dismissal, publisher Sulzberger said, was prompted by, quote, an issue with management. Stories quickly surfaced about Abramson's alleged brusque and demanding management style, but the firing also raised questions about whether women who act forcefully are also sometimes held to a different standard. In this hour of Forum, we want to explore what the firing means for the Times, for women, for the news business, and for the legacy of Jill Abramson, sent packing from the job of her dreams, tattooed tea and all. Joining us to take up this topic this morning, Jill Geisler, author of Work Happy, What Great Bosses Know. She also is the head of the Leadership and Management Program at the Poynter Institute, a journalism and education training center. Jill, good morning. Nice to talk to you again.
Hello, Dave. Good to hear your voice.
Clara Jeffrey joins us as well, co-editor of Mother Jones, the San Francisco-based magazine specializing in investigative, political, and social justice reporting. Clara Jeffrey, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Happy to have you join us. And Linda Carley joins us as well, a senior lecturer in the Department of Psychology at Wellesley College and co-author of Through the Labyrinth, The Truth About How Women Become Leaders. Linda Carley, thanks for being here, too.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So this is a fascinating story, and we should probably begin, Jill Geisler, by acknowledging from the get-go that we actually don't know a ton about what actually went down. Lots of stories surfacing. We know some things. We don't know some things. What can you tell us about what we really know?
Well, what we really know is that there's a non-disparagement agreement, and when that happens, you don't hear from the core people at the story. You hear from their friends, from their enemies, and people who know nothing at all about the issue but feel a strong need to talk about it because of their beliefs that they strongly hold. We know a few things that have been reported fairly consistently. I had a long talk with NPR's David Folkenflik last night, who's been very close to the coverage, and he said, as others have, including Ken Oletta, that the relationship between Jill and her boss was strained from the almost from the beginning. And that's kind of a red flag, if you will. And what we also know is that there was a significant amount of dysfunction among the four principal players.
And those four principal players being Sulzberger, Abramson, the new editor, I assume, Dean Baquet.
Dean Baquet, the managing editor, yes, the former managing editor, now editor, and then Thompson, who was the CEO.
And so as you look at this story, Clara Jeffrey, as another woman editor, what jumps out at you, given, as Jill describes, that there's lots that we're probably not going to know from the principals themselves, but what are you watching for? What are you hearing? What do you feel?
I think there's sort of three issues at hand. One is,
were there actual discrepancies in pay, either while she was executive editor or in previous positions, that cannot be explained by things like length of time served and therefore your pension or stock price at the time? She seemed to feel that there were or possibly were and had hired a lawyer to investigate it.
So just to step back for a moment, this is the story that both David Falkenflik at NPR, Jill Geisler mentioned, and Ken Auletta at The New Yorker have reported on, that Jill Abramson felt that she wasn't getting the same compensation that her predecessor, Bill Keller, did.
That's right. And not only that, that when she was the number two, that the number three person was perhaps paid more than she.
A story that the Times, at least, has said is not accurate.
The Times has only really addressed her salary versus Keller's salary and has somewhat hedgy language around total compensation, which could mean that stock prices were higher and so her compensation was higher, but her salary was not. We don't know. Ken Auletta this morning updated his post and did some math kind of to this point, and I encourage people to go read that. The second issue is part of the clash she had with management because she was a woman, essentially, like the same behaviors, the same be they brusque, be they pushy, which is, of course, a quality that is, you know, admirable and desired in most journalists, perceived in a different way because she was a woman. The third, putting both those two aside, is how could they treat her so badly at the moment of pushing her out the door?
And by treating her badly, you mean the abruptness of the departure?
The abruptness, the fact that, which she may have chose, but that she didn't address the staff, that it just seemed like she was booted out unceremoniously when there had been no scandal that we know about. There was no, you know, I mean, when Hal Raines was widely despised by the newsroom and oversaw a huge plagiarism.
The executive editor before Bill Keller.
That's right. Oversaw the paper at a time when Jason Blair kind of ran rampant with plagiarism. He was allowed a sort of, pretty nice ceremony on the way out, a lot of thanks from the publisher, and just treated better. And so I think part of what really rankles women is we don't know yet, and we may never know the particulars of how her tenure came to an end. But we do know that in the exit, it feels horrible.
Let's pick up on that last point then, Linda Carlin, and get your comments on the exit. It is interesting, as Claire Jeffrey describes, the contrast between that and the departure of Hal Raines, who was widely disliked at the Times but still got a more gracious send-off. And what do you make of that?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what happened in the individual case. We have all the secondhand information. It's very hard even to make the case of discrimination unless there's like a smoking gun type of thing, if there really are inequities in pay and so on. But we do know that it is impossible for women not to be viewed through a different lens than men are. And there's a vast literature on this and how people perceive leaders who are female, how they react to their assertive behavior and so on. And it seems that when you listen to the language of some discussion of negotiating over pay or being described as bossy or difficult or pushy, these are not the kinds of things you would typically hear when you're talking about men. So you wouldn't say like a man, you know, had asked for higher pay or thought he wasn't being paid enough and this was an issue, or that a man was particularly bossy when in fact he was the boss. So it seems, you know, this kind of language itself is evidence of stereotypical and discriminatory behavior, but it sets through this lens that women are examined. And to be an effective leader, there's this huge literature, what people think leaders are like. And they think, and this is true of people all around the world, all different kinds of cultures, people think the ideal leader, the successful leader, is very strong and very assertive and very directive and very forceful. And they think this, you know, men are typically very strong and very assertive and very forceful. These are characteristics that people ascribe to both men and effective leaders. But they're not the way people describe women. And they see women as kind and warm and helpful. And not only that, you know, stereotypes can be classified in different ways. We have stereotypes that are characterizing how men and women in different social groups are, but we also have stereotypes that characterize how they ought to be. And we call them in the literature prescriptive stereotypes. And to be a good woman, you have to be kind and helpful and thoughtful and compassionate and communal. And so the mere act of negotiating for a salary increase is not communal.
Right.
It's forceful. And so it is seen differently. And again, it's impossible not to see it as incompatible with appropriate being an appropriate woman. So a woman is then held to a very different standard than a man. To be a very good leader, she has to be strong and you know, competent and so on, and very forceful, but that negates her femaleness.
Yeah. Jill Geisler, you teach this stuff at the Poynter Institute in terms of trying to develop good leaders within the journalism world in particular. Wrote a book called Work Happy, What Great Bosses Know. Just on that title, I guess I'm curious. What is there something Jill Abramson didn't know? I mean, you know, that may be an unfair question, but is there – she, after all, did hire a management consultant for herself, so presumably she did feel like maybe she needed to work on that. Is there something, A, that she didn't know? And is that something that's fundamentally unfair about this situation, that women have to know certain things that men don't?
Well, I've reviewed thousands of 360 feedback reports from leaders in journalism, because that's the focus of what I do and what we require in our seminars. And I've coached countless leaders in journalism. And I think the literature is correct that when we are hiring or when we are asked to envision what we want in a leader, we want that strong, forceful, almost narcissistic, in some studies we'll say. But when people begin to work on a daily basis with people, their expectations can shift to the personal interactions they have with them. Sometimes that term is transformational leadership. Are we having a transaction or a transformation? Do I feel at the end of this connection that I have with you that you have my best interests at heart, or is this more about you as the leader? And while we have stories about male leaders like Steve Jobs or Ballmer or others who are over the top, or in fact Howell Raines, who are over the top, who have alienated many people, what I find is that when it comes down to them getting 360s, people in
by
fact,
360s, by the way, just to explain briefly that process,
sure,
that you mean.
You're required to get feedback from your boss, your peers, and direct reports. Now, I don't know if Jill Abramson's decision to hire a coach was hers or was suggested. But when people do that, it indicates that they've had some kind of feedback, as smart people will respond to, that says, I could be better in an area and I'm going to work on that. And I don't know if this was imposed on her or if it was her idea, but it's a smart thing to do, obviously. And it's generally in response to feedback that says, I need more of something from you or less of something from you. But what I do find is that if you as a colleague, as a boss, build social capital with people, then they are willing to look at your behaviors through an interesting prism. I call it the evil twin effect. I may be, in one person's eyes, I have high standards. In somebody else's eyes, I'm impossible to please. In one person's eyes, I'm a roll-up-your-sleeves-and-help kind of boss. In another person's eyes, I'm a micromanager. They see the evil twin based on the relationships that you've built with them. And that takes something that women are actually, from research, given great credit for, which is social intelligence or emotional intelligence, which tends to be overrepresented among women than men. Not in each woman individually, but on the averages.
Jill Geisler joining us from the Poynter Institute, a journalism and education and training center, along with Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones, and Linda Carley at Wellesley College, as we talk about the significance of what happened this week at the New York Times when Jill Abramson was abruptly fired. Do you share that sense, Claire Jeffrey, that there's an unfair and additional burden women have to have if they're going to be tough, if they're going to be strong, if they're going to advocate, if they're going to push, as leaders in the end all inevitably have to do, that they have to do, as Sheryl Sandberg sort of famously once said, they have to do it with a smile?
Yeah, I do generally think that that's true. I think that's true if you're the boss, and I think it's true if you're not the boss, that there's an expectation that you're both tougher and gentler. And, you know, you may have fair, middling, great social intelligence skills, but there's more of an expectation that you'll have that. And frankly, you know, so much of social intelligence is a skill, is a natural talent. It's also just time. I mean, I think everybody in every job, and certainly everybody in a newsroom these days, is pushed for time. Jill Abramson has to manage her managers and manage down the staff, but she's also got to figure out her NSA coverage and what's going on in the Ukraine. I mean, there's not a lot of hours in the day, and I think people kind of expect a more of a soft touch with women, and so that could be in play.
You can join our conversation as we continue to pursue this topic this morning. You can join us at 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page as well. Getting a number of comments already. I'd like to get your take on this one, Linda Carley. David writes in, without knowing any of the details, some of your guests are jumping immediately to the gender card. Plenty of men are unceremoniously fired. Plenty of men get paid less than some of their peers. What makes this about gender when we really don't know the details?
Well, I did say at the beginning that we don't know with absolute certainty in individual cases that this is about gender. But it is also true that it's very hard for gender not to be coloring how people respond to leaders. And, you know, on one hand, we know we have a vast literature, many, many experimental studies where the same exact behavior, the same exact style, the same exact language is treated differently in a woman than a man. So when women argue with language that's very directive, I, me, mine, they're much less likely in a negotiation to get what they're asking for than when they ask for something invoking things like we, the department, I care, and those kinds of things. So just the subtle language differences. I mean, it isn't an accident, I think, that women show these higher emotional and social cues that when they interact with others. The research on transformational leadership is pretty clear that women, on average, are slightly higher than men in most of the most important aspects of transformational leadership that predict positive outcomes, such as interacting effectively with their subordinates, communicating the mission, and so on. And so if you look at this transformational leadership, women here show this slightly superior behavior, but women, they have a whole other literature that looks at how women leaders are actually evaluated. And this is literature that looks at women in everything from education to corporate fields to the military, you name it. It's all across the board, women are held to a higher standard. So the fact that they have an effective leadership style on average, a somewhat more effective leadership style than men, does not overcome this resistance.
And just if I could get Jill Geisler's take on the degree to which recognition of that has changed at all. I mean, Jill, you were a news director a couple decades ago in a major market television station in Milwaukee. Has it changed? Are people or are we where we were when you were leading a newsroom 20, 30 years ago?
I think things have changed because I can tell you, and this is anecdotally, of course, but from the number of people who have needed support, needed additional training because they lacked the ability to lead beyond the journalism itself. They know how to lead the journalism. They don't know how to lead the people. And there was a time at which it was enough to be a good journalist. But male or female now, you're not going to get away with the autocratic behavior of a Howell Raines or the arbitrary and sometimes cruel behavior of a Rosenthal. You may get away with it for a little while, especially if you have achieved some great awards. But eventually, just as happened to Howell Raines, when something bad happened in the organization because people were afraid to talk to you about it, to challenge you about it because of your behavior, then when it all came apart, he turned around and there was no one standing behind him. If you recall Seth Mnookin's book about that event, about the Jason Blair event, he was stunned that people did not rise to his defense because he had seen this as something that was almost an injury to him because he was so important, as opposed to dysfunction in the organization that he had been a part of causing.
Presumably, Jill Abramson didn't attend one of your seminars, Jill Geisler, am I right about that?
But she didn't, and I should disclose that Dean Baquet in the past has been a member of the Poynter National Advisory Board.
The new editor.
And I
the
should
Times.
Point yeah. out that I, you know, that I have experience with Dean, and I should also point out that as a person of color, he too is often looked at through the prism of a lot of other expectations and has managed to at this point in his career gain an awful lot of followers for his management style and his journalistic style.
And is that what you would, if Jill Abramson had come to one of your seminars, if you'd talked to her about that, is that your sense that what she didn't do and needed to have done was to have cultivated those relationships and those followers so that there was strength in numbers?
I think that would be unfair of me to say. I mean, I think it's a general principle that that you build your social capital, you build trust, you build strategic alliances. It seems like a strategic alliance was the missing point here.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that you cannot go into an organization that is marked by a management team that is dysfunctional and not know that someone is going to slip off the radar. And I will say that a red flag to me was that if you shorthand the story and say when she brought in an attorney to represent her interests in pay, well, organizationally, there are usually two times you bring in an attorney. One when you're negotiating your employment contract, if you're at a high level, and one is when you're negotiating your departure. It's usually not because you have a great relationship with your manager already, your leader, and want to just have someone else speak on your behalf.
Jill Geisler joining us from the Poynter Institute. Let's open up our conversation. Lots of tweets and postings and emails coming in, calls as well. Let's get started with what you think about this topic. David joins us first in San Francisco. David, go ahead. David, are you with us?
Hello.
Yes,
hello.
You're on the air, David. Go.
Hi, yes. I think the elephant in the room, Ms. Abramson has possibly the most grating voice of any public figure in the last 20 years. I can't imagine what life must be like working with her, and that kind of affectation probably represents other kinds of difficult character traits in Ms. Abramson. And I'm wondering why no one's commenting on that.
All right, David, thank you. It is something that got some attention in reporting, the quality of Jill Abramson's voice. And Claire Jeffrey, you're rolling your eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I just have to say that she has a particular voice and a sort of particular accent. I can't imagine that would be seen as a detriment to a male journalist. I mean, she goes on Charlie Rose, she does interviews, sure, but her job is not to be on the radio or be on television. Her job is to lead the most important paper in the country.
And that point of her particular style and voice, Jill Geisler, is that something that you have to pay more attention to? I mean, you know, David raises a point that other people are probably thinking about. Is that, again, a sort of an additional burden that women have to contend with at Mendo?
I think that's a little bit of a sideshow. I deal with print, broadcast, online journalists, many of whom have what Jill Abramson had, which is a voice for print. But I don't think that and we all do impressions of our bosses' voices or mannerisms or things like that, and male or female. It certainly was something unique to her, but we forgive all kinds of things of our. I mean, if anyone ever talked to one of the most beloved bosses in journalism, Gene Roberts of the Philadelphia Inquirer, people would kid about the fact that he had a translator in the newsroom to understand what he said. Or another beloved figure like Gregory Favre, who was head of news for McClatchy and had a strong, strong New Orleans accent, and he would tease about the fact that he needed a translator. But that's not enough to have disqualified you. It is something that is unique to you.
Some comments coming in, and then we'll continue our conversation after the break. Michelle tweets in, listening to KQED Forum, I'm seriously considering canceling my New York Times subscription. Michelle writes, why is there the assumption of sexism? The Times has been a leading paper, but it's been losing a ton of market share. Maybe more going on than that. And Paula tweets, we should be suspect of difficult personality language. It's often a code for cultural unladylike stereotyping. Many more things coming in that we want to get to as we continue our conversation after the break. We welcome your contributions to that conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts as well. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the abrupt dismissal of Jill Abramson as executive editor of the New York Times this week and the fallout that's taken place since then. What it says, perhaps about Abramson herself, but also about the challenges women face in top management positions and the particular things it may say about women in journalism. We're joined by Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones magazine, Linda Carley in the Department of Psychology at Wellesley College, and Jill Geisler at the Poynter Institute. We'd like to have you join us too at 866-733-6786. One of our listeners posts this: I'm glad that Claire Jeffrey and others are tackling this subject, but as a feminist and a long ago New York Times employee, I'm concerned that the issue of Abramson's firing will devolve into a gender whine rather than giving Abramson her due as a driven editor who pushed for more investigative reporting and who tried to bring in a female editor from the more left-leaning The Guardian. That is, Abramson was very possibly ousted not for being a pushy broad, but for what she was broadly pushing for within a paper. Let's not distract from the larger political issues by focusing too intensely on cultural issues. It's an interesting point, Claire Jeffrey, because there were things that were also in play here that newspapers, your business, print journalism, is struggling with right now, particularly the issue, of course, of how you survive in the digital age. Is that sort of a context that we need to think about as well, that her dismissal took place at a time when the Times and most publications are really struggling with how they're going to continue in our present time?
Yes, and of course, that's probably one of the reasons that Bill Keller left before her, not adjusting to the changing landscape. I mean, Abramson did do a deep dive on the digital before she took the job, spent months and months trying to understand it. You know, she's a print native, as they say, but it seemed like she was really trying to get it. And bringing in Janine Gibson from The Guardian, who's digital chops and just journalism chops in general are very highly respected, that move was applauded by both her boss and the CEO. It seems like nobody quite communicated that to Dean Baquet, and that's a mistake. But I think trying to bring in someone who's known for really running a great digital operation like Janine, again, speaks to, I think, some leadership there. Now, the Times did just release a report that's been leaked that was a project headed up by the publisher's son, who's also a reporter at the paper, kind of looking at how the paper is doing transitioning to a sort of digital-first mentality. And there's frankly a lot of room for improvement. I don't agree with everything that analysis says, but it did point out that they're not doing nearly as well on sort of both just web views and social media and in other ways that they need to kind of tear down the walls between print and digital in this age. But again, that it's unknown if that report was sort of set up to be a rebuke to Abramson's leadership or if this was something that she pushed because she was trying to break down the walls between print and digital.
Let's get back to our calls. Colin joins us next in San Francisco. Colin, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. Back, you're on the air, Colin.
Back when the claims regarding Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program that were printed in the Times had been proven to have lacked foundation, I seem to recall that the only person who paid a price for that was the reporter, Judy Miller. Certainly there was no questioning of whether the Sulzberger family was the appropriate people to continue owning the Times following that scandal. Is the treatment of Judy Miller essentially making her the scapegoat for the Times' failure to properly vet that story a sign of gender bias at the Times?
Jill Geisler, why don't you respond?
I don't know that I can adequately respond to that particular question or issue. I do think it raises a question, however, about the publisher. And I think that is someone who has not been under a microscope, as has been Jill Abramson during this. And I think his leadership style should be as much of a conversation, whether it's about the Judy Miller situation or whether it's about the Jill Abramson situation. What kind of leader is he? How well does he make his selections? How well does he, in fact, groom people, support them after he hires them? If he indeed, as was stated by the spokesperson for the Times, give her some type of feedback in her evaluation, which suggested something about her performance needed to be better. What and how does he do that? And does he do it for her? And how does he do it for others? And why did he give such a long leash to someone like Howell Raines, who supervised the coverage of the Iraq buildup?
There's a pushback from our another listener on this that we're getting, I think, from a number of our callers. This listener writes, "It's absurd to argue that men who are brusque or pushy always get away with obnoxious behavior. Donald Rumsfeld, Rudy Giuliani, Rahm Emanuel, to cite just three, are men with famously sharp elbows who at various points in their careers have been subject to withering criticism. I have no idea whether Ms. Abramson is guilty of these same character traits, but I'm sick of hearing that female leaders are being held to a different standard than male leaders." Linda Carley, why don't you respond to that? A lot of people are pushing back on this. And Hal Raines, for example, someone who is very pushy and difficult, also got fired. How do you respond to that observation that men who are obnoxious get the boot as well?
Of course, men who are obnoxious get the boot, and women who are obnoxious get the boot. But it's not the question of whether you're obnoxious and you get the boot. It's a question of where the threshold is in your obnoxiousness. I mean, clearly, you know, there's obnoxious and obnoxious, and the language that you hear, you never hear men characterized as bossy or pushy. They have to be extremely strident for people to make comments about this. And the repertoire of behavior that men have access to without consequence is very broad. I mean, if, historically men had prescriptions which required them to be unemotional and unexpressive except unless it was anger. That's not true anymore. Men can be very warm and kind and expressive, and they can cry, and in fact, they get credit for these behaviors. And the newest literature is that men who show this warm, supportive, communal side are exalted in godlike fashion. They're incredible. Men can go much farther in the domain of exerting power and authority without getting penalized. So what you have is a situation where, yes, there are prescribed behaviors that get anyone into trouble, but the edges are closer together for women. Women are right; they have more limits placed on them than men do.
Is that your take as well, Joel Geisler?
You will. A woman is much more afraid to cry at work because of how it's going to be perceived. Interestingly, it's not that a man wouldn't do it. It's just that there's an automatic assumption that a woman has lost control and her emotions are ruling her. And I've worked with many women in management who worry about this because if they're empathetic. One of the challenges women often have is that because we may have been enculturated to be more empathetic, we'll sit down, we'll listen to someone's problems even as we are talking to them about their underperformance. And then when we hold them accountable still, nonetheless, people will say, well, why did she do that? Why did she turn so cold on me when I poured my heart out to her? And that's sort of the challenge that women have had, to hold people to high standards, expect high performance, and build relationships with them at the same time. I know that it's possible because I work with all kinds of men and women who do it, but I really agree with the idea that it's easy to define what's obnoxious. And the more powerful a person is, if you own the company, you get away with it. If you're a wunderkind, you get away with it, at least for a while, because everyone else benefits in some way and learns to manage in guerrilla warfare-like style around you. But when you are in the trenches, you're a mid-level manager, or you don't get away with that, male or female, for very long, the obnoxious behavior. It is what those other more subtle cues that people read are taken to be. Are you being assertive or are you being aggressive? Are you being decisive or are you being intractable? And for many women, the threshold is lower than it is for men before someone puts a negative spin on it. I've seen that.
Joel Geisler at the Poynter Institute. And you can join us at 866-733-6786 if you'd like to add your thoughts to our conversation. If you're a woman in a top management position, be interesting to hear from you, not only your reaction to what happened with Jill Abramson's firing, but in your own experience, whether any of this resonates with you in particular. What are you hearing? What are you thinking? What have you been reading, Claire Jeffrey, about the reaction within the Times itself and about how women at the Times are viewing this story? There's been some reporting about that so far, not a lot, but that there that one thing she did was to really champion the cause of different women journalists within the New York Times. Do you think that's a glummer place today?
Yeah, I do. I mean, Amanda Hess at Slate has a great article that sort of rounds up women at the Times, particularly young women at the Times, talking about how much it meant to them, not only that she was the executive editor, but that she would come out and meet them for drinks at dive bars and hang out with them and really try and figure out where their careers were going, how she could be helpful. You know, Rachel Sklar in Medium wrote a post where she met Jill, and same thing. You know, they had a long, really engaged talk, and she was just very supportive of women in that way. She went out of her way to bring a lot more women into leadership positions at the time than were there before. It's striking that, the only part of the paper that she doesn't kind of have direct control in a certain way is the op-ed page, where it's still two women to, I think, 10 guys. But, you know, in the rest of – in the sort of upper masthead, there are a lot more women there now. And that legacy hopefully will continue. So I do think that women at the Times and women more broadly, again, you know, there could be all kinds of reasons that led to her dismissal. I think the treatment of her on the way out is what is in absence of knowing the absolute facts when it comes to the pay and other issues. It's why was she treated so badly? Why was she treated much worse than her three previous predecessors who in some cases left under various kinds of clouds? And that's what feels unfair.
Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones magazine. I want to come back, if I might, for a moment to how the field of journalism is changing or whether it's changing enough. You were saying, Jill Geisler, earlier that there have been some real changes. But the Pew Research Center posted something interesting today, which reads in part, our data analysis finds that overall there's been little significant change in the share of women newsroom employees and news managers in recent years. Female journalists are generally paid less than their male counterparts, an issue which may have played a role in Abramson's exit. The past 15 years, the percentage of women who work in newspaper newsrooms has barely budged. What do you make of that, that there hasn't been more change just in the numbers, particularly in this curious phenomenon of the op-ed page, as Claire Jeffrey was saying? It's not only the Times. And generally speaking, I think the numbers are sort of 4-1. It's like we want opinion for men, but not necessarily for women.
Well, and it's not just the op-ed page. I mean, when people do content analysis of whether it's NPR or whether it's a print product, they'll see that there is an overrepresentation of male voices, underrepresentation of women's voices or sources in stories. One of the concerns when you look in journalism schools today is that they are becoming more and more female-dominated in the classes, and the concern is not that there's going to be more women doing journalism. The concern is that it's going to become a pink collar type of profession as the salaries are reduced. And we have seen that happen as layoffs and cutbacks have taken place and the senior levels of organizations have taken buyouts, so that ostensibly for sustainability, the new people who are hired are coming in at lower salaries. So for all of those reasons, we may get more women in newsrooms. We may get fewer of them still being promoted to management because they either decide to opt out or they're not being paid enough, or because the lifestyle is significantly more demanding than academia that they could choose, or perhaps public relations or work in other community activities that involve the same type of skills in communication, writing, research that they profess. So it's a complex question, but throughout it all, there still is this underlying current of women's work being devalued.
Back to our calls. Ellie joins us next from Los Gatos. Ellie, go ahead.
Yes, I believe there's a double standard for women in the workplace and in the home. In the home, the woman is expected to be strong and dominant for her children, raising her children and running the house. But if you take those aspects into the workplace, the men resent it. And I think that underlying the subconscious aspect of men toward women in the workplace is that the woman represents the mother subconsciously, and I think there's this double standard is quite prevalent in the workplace.
Ellie, thanks for the call. Thanks for adding your contribution to our conversation this morning. I want to return to one point Jill Geisler was making, Linda Carley, about the salary question, and that women, you know, may become a more female-dominated profession in part because salaries are going down. There was an interesting piece in The Atlantic a bit ago about how when college seniors are asked what they expect to be making, that male students will say, well, in 5 years, I expect to be making $100,000. But women say, well, I expect to be making $60,000. So there still seems to be a sort of something about how perhaps women view themselves or what they have a right to expect. I mean, what do you make of that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It turns out that, you know, there's this difference in what women expect their outcomes to be is somewhat vertical. I mean, they are going to not get the same level of pay and benefits as men are. So, and partly women are reporting their honest expectation of what's likely to happen. There is quite a literature on women's and men's self-perceptions, and men are much more likely to engage in self-serving bias than women do. And self-serving biases, it's perceiving yourself as somewhat better than average than you ought to perceive yourself. So there's a kind of positive glow that you put on yourself. And it's a psychological strategy that protects you from depression and makes you happy in your life and causes you to expect more from others. And in the case of men, when they go into negotiations or when they speak to and communicate with others, this kind of assumption, this confidence, is not penalized. So, in fact, the outcomes tend to be very good. Women are much more likely to be self-reflective and cautious and to, you know, be indirect in their requests and cagey. And it's because I think they're less likely to be successful when they attempt to get these benefits. So it's not necessarily that women lack self-esteem. In fact, there are no differences in self-esteem between men and women. And self-esteem is not a very strong predictor of leadership anyway. The most important predictors of leadership are intelligence, where there are no differences between men and women, and extroversion, again, no differences there. So, you know, the intrinsic qualities, the traits of men and women are not the cause of women's lack of achievement.
Linda Carley at Wellesley College. We'd be remiss if we didn't include in our conversation Jill Abramson's accomplishments and what she brought to the New York Times and what her legacy, presumably, of course, she'll go on to do more things in her career. But as you look at her tenure at the Times, Claire Jeffrey, what do you see? What did she bring to the Times? What is that part of this story that we ought to make sure is noted as well?
Well, I think she has begun the long, hard task of kind of updating the paper's approach to digital, both in terms of the journalism and in terms of the business. There's obviously been amazing reporting on, you know, everything from foreign affairs to the NSA to Andrea Elliott's fabulous piece on families on welfare in New York City, which was, you know, real searing expose of the Bloomberg administration. So there's been a lot of great journalism, and you know, I don't think that anyone. I have not heard the criticism that her paper was a lesser paper. You know, the Times has, over the past decade, had to cut back a lot, and those pains have been felt. And I think there were hard choices made, and sometimes people who left the paper who were missed. But I've never really heard the criticism that her paper was somehow less. If anything, the opposite.
Yes, really interesting observation. How do you see that, Jill Geisler?
I would agree. I think she did elevate women in the organization. I think in content there has been reports that people were much more comfortable bringing up issues that were important to women, which is one of the things that the American Society of News Editors, now called News Editors, once called Newspaper Editors, did a few years ago on the status of women, which said that one of the reasons that women were leaving, and leaving even in leadership roles, was that they did not feel that their ideas were being heard, especially around stories that they were proposing that had an impact on women. And so I didn't hear that at all. I heard the contrary about the kind of climate that Jill Abramson fostered at the paper. So for all of those things, she deserves credit.
Let's get in another call before we need to take a break. Natasha in San Jose joins us. Natasha, go ahead.
Hi. So I'm a director at a mid-sized private company that is very male-based in telecommunications, and grew up believing in equality and went to a Seven Sister, Bryn Mawr. But then after getting out into the workforce and getting some very negative feedback, including the sound of my voice, it wasn't what I was saying, it was the sound of my voice, I changed my strategy, actually based on some of the stories that we've had on forum, to become much more gender normative. I actually worked on changing the sound of my voice and then started dressing more feminine, wearing dresses a lot, growing my hair out long. And then that way, when I need to show more leadership qualities, be more assertive, it comes across as like, oh, well, we love her because she's so sweet.
And so, Natasha, I mean, are you cool with that? I mean, it sounds like it's worked for you, but what do you make of that?
You know, there was a mother-daughter that you had on that had written a book, and the mother was just like, we shouldn't have to do this. And the daughter's like, do we want to be right or do we want to be successful? And I would rather be successful, and I would rather go through those glass ceilings than to say, this isn't fair. It's not fair. But you do what you have to do in order to be successful.
Yeah, Natasha, thank you.
The whole story has been very sad.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for adding your perspective. Claire Jeffrey, a reaction?
I agree with that, and I think we all do it to a certain extent. But I do think that, you know, we should be hopeful for a time where it's not so much that women have to adjust to the workplace as the workplace needs to accommodate women. And that's accommodating, you know, our somewhat different appearance and our different tones of voices, but it's also doing basic things to accommodate you know, family structure and family demands that should not be shoved off onto just working women, but should be shared equally by working parents in the workplace.
Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones magazine, joining us along with Jill Geisler at the Poynter Institute, Linda Curley at Wellesley College. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information on how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. And back to our calls. Let's go next to Lauren in San Francisco. Lauren, go ahead.
Hi. I would like to thank everyone for this conversation. I think it's very important. But I'd like to point out one thing. In my over 15 years of experience in the technology industry in sales, I feel that my biggest advocates, supporters, and allies have been men, and the worst experiences I've ever had have been with other women. And I think this is not a conversation about demonizing men or saying men are holding us down. I think it's really the nature of women's relationships with other women. I see men helping each other up, boosting each other, supporting each other to get where they want to be. However, with women, it seems like if they think they want to succeed, they need to push down the nearest, most successful woman around them so they can shine brighter. And I think this is a conversation that needs to be had among women. And, you know, I have to be honest with you. Yes, there's a lot of men, you know, that are decision makers. But with Jill Abramson, I don't know how many layers of women that had any influence in this decision making, but I can guarantee you there were women. And so I'll take my answer off the line.
Yeah,
Thank you. Interesting.
Lauren, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Linda. You know, the truth of the matter is we actually know quite a bit about how men and women respond to men and women's behaviors and how they respond differently. And it turns out that it is true that both men and women hold women to a very high standard of niceness. And you'll often hear women complain that other women don't do enough for them, aren't supportive enough for them, aren't there for them, or didn't pull them up. And actually, those complaints are another manifestation of this discriminatory behavior. Because the women at the top are often in small numbers, and there are lots of other women below them they're trying to mentor. They have a lot of pressure on them relative to men. Men, you know, they may have a couple of proteges they're mentoring. There are a lot of men around, a lot of men to mentor other men. The networks are very strong and entrenched. So the women are already in a difficult position. And part of the problem here is that, you know, the women are holding themselves to the same standards that the men are holding the women to. But it's the women who are expecting these women to help them that makes it particularly hard. And it turns out it is not the case that women are harder on women than men are. They're not.
Yeah.
That is not true. But everyone expects women to be so kind and so thoughtful. And so the standards are very high for women's support and mentoring of other women. And God forbid women who don't do this.
Yeah, interesting. And Jill Geisler, how do you work with that? I mean, do you work specifically on how women can be sort of shoulder to shoulder and supporting each other?
Well, I just want to support what's been said because, again, and this is my anecdotal but pretty deep evidence from working with so many leaders and seeing so much of the feedback, I don't see that complaint disproportionately registered toward the women in leadership that I work with. I'm not seeing people in their feedback saying, you're not there for me, any more than I am among men. Anecdotally, we all have people who will critique our performance, and we're going to have, you know, people who are our fans and people who feel that we've underserved them. But I will tell you that I've coached men on their voices. I've coached men on their presentation because you've got someone who is being less effective than he can be in the way he communicates. And I've also coached men and women whose direct reports felt that they did not get sufficient training, feedback, support, mentoring. I hear about these cases anecdotally when people will say, I worked for a woman and I expected more from her because I'm a woman. But I don't see pound for pound that women are doing anything that is neglectful to other women in the feedback that I review.
And last, Claire Jeffrey, what do you take from all this? What do you take back to your own newsroom? What is it that we can take from this sad week, really, on many levels that that can help promote the kind of newsroom we'd all like to be a part of?
I mean, hopefully this will prompt a discussion that is really, truly heard and felt at the Times and at other newsrooms. The fact that the number of women in leadership positions in newsroom is basically flatlined since 1998, as the Pew study you quoted earlier reports, this is not good. We're not making enough progress. And I think these very subtle issues of how women are perceived, how they project themselves, this really needs to be taken into account. I do take hope in that I feel that younger men that I know, men my own age and younger than that, have grown up in an environment where they're more sensitive to these issues. And it may just be that, you know, we're kind of only 30 years away from the sort of Peggy Olson scenarios of the workplace. And, you know, it's not happening as quickly as we'd like. But hopefully I think the men, too, will help the women make a better, more equitable workplace.
Claire Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones magazine. Claire, thanks for being on our program this morning.
Thank you.
Jill Geisler joined us as well, Leadership and Management Program Director at the Poynter Institute. Jill, great to talk with you again. Thank you.
You too, Dave.
And Linda Carley, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Psychology at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Linda, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Pleasure to have all of you on our program. Fascinating topic, one no doubt we'll continue to talk about here in our own newsroom as well as on the air. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. David Marks provides online assistance. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.